Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. On the morning of March 18, 1990, two thieves disguised as Boston police officers entered the Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum and cut 13 masterworks out of their frames and disappeared. Those works of art, including a Vermeer and four works by Edgar Degas, have never been recovered. Collectively, the artworks are estimated to be worth $500 million or more, making it the largest unsolved art theft in history. Well, my guest today uses that incident as a starting point and imagines what if one turned up. In fact, that's the premise for the literary thriller, The Art Forger. B.A. Shapiro is my guest. She takes us into the seedy world of art theft and the question of why anyone would steal art. Art is a worldwide market. Most pieces are singular objects. But yet, thefts persist. And what if one turned up? We meet Claire Roth, a talented young Boston artist whose career is sidelined after her participation in a scandal involving an acclaimed modern painter. To make ends meet, she makes copies for a reproduction service. But when a powerful art dealer promises a gallery show in exchange for forging one of those stolen Degas paintings, Claire makes a Faustian bargain, and that's the start of The Art Forger. It's published by Algonquin Books, that's Chapel Hill. B.A. Shapiro is my guest. She teaches at Northeastern University in Boston, and she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. B.A. Shapiro, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This book was, it sounds like it was a long time in the making. As I understand it, you wanted to originally write about Isabel Stewart Gardner, the great art collector. She was sort of this live spirit in the beginning of the 20th century, collected great artworks. Today, the Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum holds most of those. The Art Forger does this, but ever so obliquely. Tell us about your fascination with Gardner.
Well, Isabella Stewart Gardner was an amazing woman. As you said, she lived around the turn of the 20th century, but she had the heart of a contemporary woman. And at that time, this really was quite unheard of, particularly in her set. She was amongst the very wealthy Brahmins in Boston. But she didn't care. She did things like walking lions down the main street in the city, and she went to the symphony with a headband that said, "Go Red Sox." And she became the first great American collector, man or woman, at a time when women sat at home and, you know, made little cards and visited each other. So that captured me when I first found out about her. And I always wanted to write a book about her, but I couldn't get my head around a really good way to do it. And so it wasn't until after the robbery that happened at her museum in 1990, and after I started spending a lot of time in Boston in the museums and the galleries, that the whole thing came together. And yes, she did become a background piece, but an important background piece.
Now, do you have a background in art? Because we learn more about the art of forgery than I think most people ever would want to know.
I've been told that if you knew how to paint, you could be a forger after reading this book. I love that question because I have no background in art history. And I only have a love of art. I have no training. I'm not an artist. But I got to create a character who's an artist, and then live vicariously through her as if I were actually being the artist.
Now, is that accurate information, or was this fiction? The art of the forgery, which is, you know, we learned that we can age the tacks, you know, just putting them in water for 2 weeks. You learn in the course of the book, we see that they actually use an actual canvas from the same era, but it was a less important painting, strip it down and create the forgery.
All of the forgery facts are true. I did a lot of research and talked with a lot of people. And so the facts are all true. And all of the techniques that the main character, Claire, uses are actual techniques. But the fictional part is in the character. So she's a made-up character.
Yes, obviously.
But what she does is not.
Well, let's explain a little bit about the plot. At the beginning, we're meeting Claire Roth, who's a talented young painter, but she is struggling. She's making, and this is probably a revelation to a lot of people, and this is part of the interest of the book, is that there is a vibrant copying. We think of, museum reproductions, but, if you want to buy a copy of a painting, any painting in the world, it's out there on the internet. And this is what Claire's doing. She's working for one of these .com painting reproduction providers. And so she's copying famous paintings all the time. And she's approached with a very interesting offer. And explain how we meet Claire Roth at the beginning of the book.
Well, when we meet Claire, she is a struggling artist. But worse than that, she has, because of a scandal in the past, she has become a pariah in the art community and is forced to work for reproductions.com because no one will show her paintings. They won't even consider her in any contests. And she's very, very frustrated. She's approached in the first chapter by the largest gallery owner in Boston, and he offers her a Faustian bargain. If she will paint a forgery for him, then he will give her $50,000 and her own one-woman show at his gallery, which will catapult her career.
There's an altruistic part of this Faustian bargain in that this involves the theft of art from the Gardner Museum in 1990.
Correct.
Now, for people who don't remember the Gardner Museum theft, was it 13 works of art, probably
yes.
worth $500 million? We're talking a Vermeer,
right.
a Rembrandt, several Degas, a variety of Impressionist work, and the robbery's never been solved.
It is really a bizarre and fascinating story. The Isabella Stewart Gardner isn't like most museums. It actually was originally, she built it to house her collection and to live in. And then when she died, she gave it to the city of Boston. And it's probably one of the most unique art museums anybody will ever go to. And they, they were a small museum and they really didn't think much about security. And they had a couple of guards who really were more like, handymen to make sure that the boiler didn't overflow. Guarding the museum one night in 1990, and two men dressed as policemen came in, tied up the guards, and then spent 81 minutes ripping all of these masterpieces out of their frames. As you said, they took Rembrandt's only seascape. They took the concert by Vermeer, which is one of my all-time favorite paintings, along with a number of other very valuable paintings, and then a few things of no value at all. Then they put them under their arms, and they walked outside, threw it in their rusty old Datsun, and drove away with what now is considered roughly $500 million worth of artwork. Nothing has ever been found. Nothing has ever surfaced. The FBI and the Boston police have been on the case for 22 years, and there's nothing. It was a sloppy robbery. It wasn't well done, and meanwhile, they have gotten away with what still is, even after the Rotterdam robbery, the largest art theft in history.
This whole idea of art theft strikes me as very strange. I mean, this is a different realm. There's only so many places you can go to sell a Vermeer or a Rembrandt.
Yes.
And Interpol is probably better organized against art theft than just about any other type of crime. I don't understand how people are selling it unless they're finding they have a willing buyer who wants to put it up in their house and sort of have this sort of pathological relationship with this painting because they can never show it to anybody. They can never sell it. What is the point of art theft? I'm really having a hard time figuring that out.
Well, first of all, thieves aren't the brightest people in the world. But
this
aside from that, yes, you're correct. Despite the movies and the glamorized notion of some guy sitting in a cave surrounded by all of these valuable paintings, it very rarely is the case. And in the case of the Gardner heist, it's particularly unusual because they cut the paintings out of the frames, and if they were trying to, if a collector had instructed them to do this, he would have told them to keep it in the frame. But generally, what happens is they end up being used as collateral on the black market.
This was something I had never heard of. Explain how this works.
Well, the example that I use in the book, what they do, people do this for drugs, for guns, terrorists use it sometimes. Groups will exchange. The IRA would steal paintings and as if they were kidnapping them, and then they would ransom them off. I mean, there are all different ways to do this, but primarily what happens is, say you're a drug dealer and somebody comes to you and says, I have some cocaine. You can have $1 million worth of it, and you can turn it into $5 million in the street in a week. But you don't have $1 million. What you do have is a $50 million Degas. So you go to the money man, and you say, you give me $1 million, I'll give you this Degas as collateral, and then I'll come back in a week, and I'll give you $2 million. So he gives you the $1 million, you go out, you make your deal, you get your $5 million, you go back to him, you give him the two, you take the painting, and you've got $3 million and a painting to now go and do the whole thing again.
Very interesting. Well, obviously this heist, it happened, 22 years ago now. Mm-hmm. I think you wanted to write about it afterwards, but you set it aside, and eventually an amount of time passed, and of course none of these paintings have ever showed up. You decided to write about it, right?
Well, it is so fascinating. Like, what could have happened? I don't answer that in the book, although I raise a lot of questions and possibilities, because that's the state of knowledge right now. And I wanted to write a book about this and a book about Isabella Stewart Gardner, or Belle, as I call her. That's what her friends called her, and I consider myself a friend after writing this book. And I wanted to write something, but I couldn't figure out how could I write a book about Belle when she died in the early 20s, and the heist didn't happen until the 1990s. So it wasn't until I moved into Boston and was walking distance to all of these great galleries and museums that the idea started to form of a way to, involve all of these elements in a single story.
Now, one of the interesting points you bring up, one of these little side things, is that, art forgery is not new.
That's for sure.
It goes back as long as there's been art, probably.
Yep.
And, when you look at the sheer amount of reproductions that are out there today, I wonder how many, when you go to a museum, how many of these works are actually the works of the artists, and what we might be a very good forgery. I mean, every once in a while you hear of a museum saying, oh, this is not what we thought it was.
Yeah, and actually it's not so once in a while. It happens quite frequently. The New York Times has estimated that 40% of all of the artwork that goes on sale at large auction houses like Christie's and Sotheby's in any given year are forgeries.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's just incredible. And when I push that statistic on people in the field who know about it, they all acknowledge that it was possible, that this wasn't so out of line, which blew me away. And one of the people at the Met said, yeah, we only know about the bad forgeries. All the good ones are hanging on museum walls.
That's pretty interesting. And, considering the fact that the art market today is as hot as it's ever been, in fact, probably more money going into the art market than, gold and art market at this point, that's the haven for the super rich these days. The idea that nearly half could be forgeries, well, that's pretty out there.
Well, the thing that's really interesting is that this has actually been in the news lately. There's a big gallery in New York that
several have gone broke.
Yeah, right. But they're being sued, for selling these paintings. But the funniest thing, I learned this recently, I wish I had known it so I could have put it in the book, is what's starting to happen now is there are people who make their living, authenticating paintings, and they're highly trained and skilled and educated. And now what's happening is that a collector will go to an authenticator and with what he or she assumes is a $50 million painting, and then the authenticator says, no, this is a fake and it's worth nothing. And then the collector is suing the authenticator.
Right, yeah.
In fact, he just lost $50 million.
Some foundations of artists who authenticate paintings have basically said, we're not doing this anymore.
We're not doing it anymore. Yep. But this is also, this goes to one of the central questions in the book, which is, okay, so you've got this painting, say, a Degas that's been hanging in the Gardner Museum. And for 100 years, people have walked by it, and they've loved it, and they've derived pleasure from it. And, you know, people have written their doctoral dissertations on it. And suddenly it is declared a forgery. Is the painting less beautiful? Was the pleasure that people derive from it not real? Should the people who got their PhDs, you know, be stripped of them? I mean, where is the value? How does it get there? You know, how does society apportion value, both in things like art and then other things like people and their jobs? And so this is a recurrent theme, which forgery is the metaphor for in the book, as each person struggles with their own authenticity.
My guest today is B.A. Shapiro. She's written a wonderful novel titled The Art Forger, which uses the theft of art from the Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum in 1990 as a starting point, as a young artist is approached with this Faustian bargain, as B.A. referred to it, to create a forgery in which the idea is that maybe one of the real paintings come back, but it also gets this idea of, if you've been looking at a forgery, admiring it, and enjoying this artwork for 100 years, does it really matter if it was painted by Degas or any of the great masters? Is a beautiful painting a beautiful painting, or is it only a beautiful painting and worth something if it comes from an artist known for creating many beautiful paintings? That is a really interesting question.
It also goes to something I actually am a sociologist. I have a PhD in sociology, and it goes to something I've always been very interested in, is, you know, what different societies and different cultures consider valuable. And in our society today, where if your name is Kardashian, you have value, and teachers have little value, it raises these questions that I hope people will think about when they're reading the book, that it's not just about high art, it's about all kinds of things.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if it's a sign of changing times, but if you look at an altarpiece that was created 1,000 years ago, or, mm-hmm. you know, 1,200 years ago, we have no idea who did that.
Right.
We admire it for its great beauty and its intrinsic value. But if you look at a painting created 150 years ago, unless it has that name on it, we can look at an equally good painting that doesn't have the name, and there's no question of a diminished value.
That's a really good point. Another example is this book. Actually, this is kind of meta in terms of writing the book and then having this happen. But this book got rejected by many publishers. And I was actually on the verge of just giving up, but my agent wouldn't let me. And she got it to Algonquin, and then Algonquin published it, and now it's hit the Times bestseller list. This is the same book that almost sat in my drawer that had no value. Now suddenly it has value. It's the same thing.
Right. What did you hear from publishers other than, you know, thank you very much, this is not in our interest? Was there something about it was it too esoteric? Did they feel like nobody wants to read about art or what?
What they felt, and this again goes to what society values, is that the book couldn't be categorized. People said to me, well, if you make it more of a thriller, we'd like to see it again. Other people said, well, if you make it more chick lit, we'd like to see it again. And, you know, I've been writing for many years, and I was tired of this. And I said, no, this is what the book is. I wanted it to be, you know, a braiding of a lot of different styles and themes. And this is what I wanted. But they said they didn't know how to package it, and they didn't know how to promote it. And so even though they liked it, nobody ever said they didn't like the book or they didn't think it was good, they didn't know how to sell it. Algonquin Books, who is my publisher, is a very small, prestigious literary house. and they are known for getting behind their books. The large booksellers, the large publishers might publish 100 books a month. Algonquin publishes 25 a year. So they get behind their books, and they are just amazing. And when I told my editor this story, and I said nobody knew what the book was, so they didn't know what to do with it. And she looked at me kind of puzzled, and she said, "It's a novel." And I was like, oh, I almost cried. Yes, it's a novel. It's a novel.
Well, we see the themes that the plays out in The Art Forger is not limited to art. It's limited to all art, including writing as well. The name of the book is The Art Forger. My guest today is B.A. Shapiro. Now, one of the things I found interesting was you obviously had to spend a lot of time learning about Degas. The artist, Claire, is methodical in not only learning about the painting she's making a copy of or forging, and there's a distinction there. You can make a copy, but when you try to sell it as original, that's a forgery. I'd never really thought of the difference until the book. But, you know, she's fully engrossed in Degas' world, which obviously, as the writer, you had to be. What did you learn the most interesting facts about Degas?
Well, I learned a lot of really interesting things about him. He started out as many of, you know, the Impressionists did, as a very traditional painter, you know, more working in the style of say, Rembrandt than the Impressionist, and evolved through that to get to the works that he is most well known for. And he was a gregarious yet solitary man. As far as I could see from my research, he never was involved with a woman or a man or anybody in a romantic relationship. He was close to his family, and he had a lot of friends, but he was really quite a loner. And the life of these artists in Paris at the time that they started to become, the school of Impressionism was starting to develop, they were scorned. They were just, you know, belittled. You know, they're just throwing lumps of paint on the canvas, and they're not, you know, using any of their artistic skills, and people just turned their noses up. And these men and women persisted and kept doing it until ultimately it became the Impressionist school, which so many people love. So again, it's the struggling artist piece, the struggling creative person, whether it's writing or art or music, people are out there all the time pushing the edges. And I really like that idea.
You know, in the case of Degas, we know him for his dancer paintings,
right.
and he also loved to paint horse racing. But,
yes.
But and there was the other series, which is what the book focuses on, a series of paintings and pastels called After the Bath, in which he was in the boudoir as women were either bathing out of a wash basin or coming out of the bathtub, a series of semi-nudes and nudes, and he was very fascinated by that.
Well,
numerous paintings.
It wasn't just the bath paintings. It was what he started doing is he began painting pictures of people in real life,
yes.
Doing ordinary things, and they weren't particularly attractive. They were just people, and he was one of the first to do that. And this, too, was scorned. You know, who wants to look at these women that are like washerwomen or laundry women or, you know, women whose bodies aren't that great? But he was fascinated by the ordinary, way ahead of reality TV.
Yeah. And, of course, these paintings were at once incredibly candid and intimate at the same time, in which you're an unseen observer to the scene.
Yeah, that's really well put.
So anyway, Claire is immersing herself. She's doing this. At the same time, there's this, getting back to Belle, which is where we started, Isabel Stewart Gardner, she enters the story in your mind's eye, which is that perhaps in her trips to Europe, maybe she encountered some of these artists.
Well, I know that she encountered many artists. Part of what she did was cultivate, and in Boston she held these soirees with all of the famous and up-and-coming writers and artists and musicians of the day. She was very good friends with people like Singer Sargent and all of the big artists of the time. And I needed, for the story, an artist that she would interact with when she went back and forth to Europe, primarily to Paris and Venice, which is where she acquired all of her paintings. And she knew many, many artists. And so I chose Degas because he was in many of the same places that she was at the same time, and they had a group of intimate friends that they each knew, although I could never find a historical incident where it clearly said that they had met.
Interesting, interesting. Well, getting back to the heist in 1990, do you think any of those paintings will ever show up? It's been 22 years. They were ripped out of the, in fact, the empty frames are still shown at the Gardner Museum. Do you think that any of them will ever show up?
I hope so. Nobody knows. There is basically only hope. If they're being used on the black market, as I speculated before, perhaps they are being taken care of. That's the most important thing. You know, great art can't be left in a basement or an attic. It needs to be kept and kept well. So, I don't know. Paintings have surfaced this long after a heist, although usually they surface earlier. The suspects in this case have ranged from the Catholic Church to the IRA to
Whitey Bulger,
the Mafia, and Whitey Bulger.
Of course, we have a connection with Whitey Bulger because he was involved in a hit for hire here in Tulsa in the early 1980s.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. Good old Whitey. Well, now he's behind bars, so he's going to get his due.
So obviously Whitey was not the person behind the theft, though.
There are some people who still think he was, but I personally don't think it was the Mafia. If it had been the Mafia, something would have come up by now. You know, there would have been so many people involved. Somebody would have known something. A painting would have surfaced. It just, I don't think it makes any sense.
Is it possible they're sitting in an attic or a basement, as you mentioned earlier?
It's possible. As I was also saying earlier, thieves are not that smart. And given the sloppiness of this, it's possible that they did it kind of on a lark and then realized, as you said, you know, what are you going to do with it? And, you know, maybe they are. It would be really bad because that would mean that they're probably in bad shape after 22 years. There are many possibilities, and nobody really knows. If I were going to venture a guess, I would guess it might have been the IRA, because they were at war with Britain at the time, and they were known for stealing paintings and using them as ransom and things like that. And it also seems to me what happened was they locked the two guards up in the basement, and they weren't found until the next morning because they didn't have a very good security system. And it seems to me that if you took these paintings and got them out of the country immediately, that's one way to have succeeded at this. What they did with them, where they might be, who knows? Who knows?
All right. It's a fascinating book. The Art Forger. B.A. Shapiro, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
B.A. Shapiro is the author of The Art Forger, published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.